This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Last week, VPR's Kathleen Masterson visited Roxham Road in Champlain, New York. She went to this rural spot, nudged up against the Canadian border, because it's become a bit of a thoroughfare for people in the United States to illegally cross the border. They're not trying to sneak across. They're doing it with the specific aim of getting caught by Canadian authorities. Then they hope to be taken into custody and start asylum proceedings. While Kathleen was waiting, a taxi with Vermont plates pulled up with a woman and her child.
Good luck.
Okay, I'll go. She doesn't want to talk and seems to have limited English. She hugs her baby to her chest and with her free hand pulls behind her a black suitcase on wheels. As she moves toward the ditch, several Canadian police officers approach on their side and speak to her.
Okay, you have to go through the custom border. But if you do cross here, you'll be arrested. And then we'll take you in charge. Okay?
The woman nods, seeming to understand that she will be arrested, and she steps toward them. The Canadian policeman offers to carry her baby as she makes her way through the slippery snow path. She hands him the child, then takes the hand of the other officer who helps her to the road on the Canadian side. The police bring out a car seat and place it into the vehicle. The whole thing takes about 6 minutes.
You can hear the rest of that story at vpr.net, and we'll be talking with Kathleen Masterson from Canada, where she continues to do reporting in a little while. The reason so many people are crossing illegally is because of something called the Safe Third Country Agreement. This was an agreement signed by the U.S. and Canada that went into effect in 2004. The pact is meant to prevent shopping for asylum in both countries. It requires refugees seeking asylum to declare their intention in the country they arrive in. So if they hit the U.S. first, they can't then travel on to Canada in the hopes of finding a more receptive climate. But if they cross illegally, they get arrested and get caught up in the legal system, and then they are free to declare asylum. There's anecdotal evidence that this kind of activity is on the rise since the election of Donald Trump. We're going to talk about that today, and we're also going to look at this cross-country agreement that created the particular situation happening now. Some Vermonters were very vocal opponents of it. We're joined first today by Eric Taifar, an immigration lawyer in Montreal. Eric, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon.
Later on in the program, we're going to talk a little bit more in detail about this pact that prevents people from crossing legally and declaring asylum at a regular boarding crossing. But basically, they can't do it because they're not supposed to be able to cross back and forth. You're an immigration lawyer, and you work on these kinds of cases. Have you noticed an increase in the number of people seeking asylum in Canada?
Yes, there's been a steady augmentation since 2012, but since November, there's really been a spike. I think we're talking about nearly 500 applications in January this year versus around 52 last year. So there's a five-fold increase at least.
And do you have a sense of why?
It's a combination of factors. There's factors, for instance, in the Middle East and Africa that make it so there's more claimants. But there's also factors on the other side of the border in the United States. We've been seeing a lot of people coming in since November. A lot of them are talking to us about the election, about President Trump, about the general feeling of insecurity that they're having now since the election. And also, we get a lot of comments about how long it is to actually get refugee status in the United States and how much it costs. Some people telling me that sometimes, you know, to file an actual claim with a lawyer, it would cost them $10,000 to $15,000 U.S.
Is it cheaper in Canada?
Yes, because most of these people would be admissible to a legal aid, as we call it here, which is basically a bit like having a public defender funded by the state to do the application.
So asylum seekers in Canada are given a lawyer.
They can file for legal aid if they're financially admissible. If not, they can find a private lawyer just like they do in the United States. But in the Montreal area, the costs are way lower than what you would see in the United States. There's no comparison.
And is the bar lower in Canada for people to actually get asylum than it is in the United States?
No, I don't think the bar is lower because it stays the same refugee convention. It's just the way that we administer it. So, for instance, when you file for refugee status in Canada, just like these people are doing at the border, they have a hearing within 45 days. Which is very, very way faster, sorry for the expression, than in the United States when it where it takes years. So already the difference in time is a big incentive for the people to cross.
I understand Canada also uses detention very sparingly, so people have a little bit more freedom to move if they're in asylum proceedings.
Yeah, exactly. We only detain refugee claimants that cannot be identified or that represent a danger to the public. Otherwise, the people are free to go. They actually rent, for instance, their own apartments. They're given work permits. They have to ask for it, but they're admissible for a work permit. They also get Medicare for the duration of their claim. So they live in the general population. There's almost no detention.
We're talking with Eric Taifar, an immigration lawyer in Montreal, and we're looking today at this issue of people crossing the border illegally into Canada in order to declare asylum. Listeners, if you have a question or a comment you'd like to share, our number is 1-800-639-2211. Again, 1-800-639-2211. You can also post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Eric, what's the immigration status of the people in the United States before they cross into Canada? Who are they? What is their immigration situation?
We see, I'd say, two general groups. One of them is people that are visitors that simply obtained visitor visas for the United States. They stay for a couple of days in the United States and then come straight to Canada. So those people are like tourists in the United States. And are basically just using the country as a platform to come here. The other group is people that came to the United States before, were there for several months and were either refugee claimants over there or were illegal in the States. So that's the two groups that we see.
Once they arrive in Canada and are arrested for crossing illegally into the country, what exactly happens to them?
They're brought to the nearest border crossing. Immigration office where they file some initial forms and paperwork to see if their refugee claim is admissible. So, for instance, if somebody has a criminal record, then he's going to be barred from asking refugee status right on the spot. But if there's no inadmissibility, then once that is done, they're going to be given their Medicare papers and a bus ticket for Montreal. As well as several addresses where they can go to get services. When the people arrive at first, usually they live for a few weeks at the YMCA, downtown Montreal, until they find their own apartment. And after that, they're going to be given resources over there to find a lawyer or to see a doctor, to enroll the kids in school if there's any case like that. And their hearing should be normally 45 days after they arrived at the border.
Eric, do Canadians have any security concerns about allowing these people into the country and then allowing them to have the freedom to go where they want to? I mean, this idea of here's a bus ticket to Montreal, but nobody's following you. Nobody has you in handcuffs. You know, good luck.
No, I don't think there's a security concern. I mean, if anybody gives even the shadow of a doubt to an immigration officer that he might pose a security threat, he's arrested on the detained, and he can be kept detained basically indefinitely if he represents a risk. If not, I mean, we do a lot of vetting at the border when the people arrive, and there's also constant verifications during the whole process to make sure that we haven't missed anything. I don't think anybody is really worried about this security-wise. Of course, the numbers are starting to stress people a little bit, but the system is still able to handle them.
And that number that you mentioned at the beginning that you've seen about 500 people who have been asking for help, is that representative of the number you think are crossing the border in total?
It's a good estimate, at least from what we see in different practitioners' offices and what we see at the refugee board and in terms of files being opened So I think that the 500 number is pretty much on the spot.
Eric, the Safe Third Country Agreement takes as its premise that both the United States and Canada are safe countries for migrants and refugees, so that if you land in one country or the other and are required to then declare asylum in that country, you're going to be safe, whether you're in the United States or Canada. Mm-hmm. Is there any conversation happening in Canada to suggest that the country would break this agreement because it no longer believes the United States to be safe for these people?
There's a growing lobby against the agreement. Of course, even when the agreement was signed at first, a lot of people were against it. But now that we're seeing all those numbers, the contesting has stepped up. I know the minister stated last week that he had no intention of going back on the agreement, but honestly, I it's hard to understand why, because the only people benefiting from this agreement are people smugglers that get paid to bring people to the border and help them cross illegally. I mean, the Canadian authorities have to run around to try to find these people because they're not crossing at the border. American Border Patrol have to run after these people when they spot them as well. So it's not helping the Americans, it's not helping the Canadians, it's not helping the refugee claimants at all. The only people who are being helped are the people who basically are criminals and are helping these people cross for enormous amounts of money.
That's Eric Taifar, an immigration lawyer in Montreal who's been working and looking at some of these cases. Eric, thank you very much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
We are going to be talking next about the law that has helped set up the situation where people have to cross the border illegally in order to declare asylum. If you have questions about that or memories of the time, perhaps just before the Safe Third Country Agreement went into effect, when Vermonters also saw a surge of people crossing the border, let us know. You can post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. or call 1-800-639-2211. Again, that's 1-800-639-2211. Let's go to Mark calling in from Montreal. Hi, Mark. Go right ahead.
Hi, I was listening, and I do appreciate what Eric is saying. I'm very concerned about the smuggling of human traffic, essentially. It's a little bit different than essentially a form of human trafficking. I'm very concerned about people coming over in winter. As you know, in Manitoba, there was a few men that had frostbite and lost their fingers in the desperate attempt to try and get across the border. I think that also there is already something of a backlash in Canada that also concerns me, because as you know, there are certain efforts to outlaw Islamophobia and also vandalism against mosques here, because there is a number of people, I believe I've heard from the CBC that there was, I think, 25 or 30% of Canadians are in favor of some kind of ban on immigration as well, similar to what Trump proposed. So I'm afraid that the publicity about the immigrants coming across is actually going to encourage a lot more. I'm all for legal immigration. My parents were immigrants from the Netherlands. I think it's great. I think we should accept refugees. I'm just very concerned the notion that we're taking refugees from a country that is already safe. I understand the politics and the fear of deportation, but in essence, they're not fleeing from any imminent danger from the United States. I do understand that they do not have immigration status. They're illegal, either illegal or passing through the United States.
Or in some cases are perhaps going through asylum proceedings, but don't feel
like
they'll
get them. And then so it seems as if they're already doing asylum proceedings there and then just sort of bolt for Canada because they're afraid or whatever. So I think that there should be public statements made by officials in both Canada and the United States that are discouraging this and creating some kind of process that is legal either legal or is going to control the situation. I also heard that in Manitoba, there was a story about they are already full to the brim with their centers. They don't have
Mark,
more.
I'm going to stop you because I hear your point, and it's really interesting. And what you're bringing in here are a lot of pieces of the context that we're going to get into here with this agreement and why it was started and how it's had an effect. And so I appreciate your perspective from Montreal and others listening in Canada. If you want to call in again, our number 1-800-639-2211, wherever you're interested in calling from or if you have questions. Mark, thank you. We turn now to Patrick Giantonio, a former executive director of the Vermont Refugee Assistance. That's an organization that isn't around anymore, but it did help asylum seekers in Vermont for 30 years, starting in the 1980s. Patrick, welcome to the program. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you, Jane.
Before we get into some of the details of the actual legal specifics, can you talk just a little bit about what was the impetus for this agreement? It was signed in 2002. It went into effect in 2004. Why did the U.S. and Canada need this safe third-party agreement or third-country agreement?
Thanks, Jane. That's a really good question. And the safe third-country agreement was originally part of post 9/11, there were several different policies that happened both in the U.S. and between the U.S. and different countries, in this case Canada. The Safe Third Country Agreement was one point of a 30-point what was called the Smart Border Accord that was signed in December 2001. The agreement then was actually signed – the Safe Third Country Agreement was signed in December of 2002, and as you said, it was implemented in 2004. The Safe Third Country Agreement, again, was part of this 30-point agreement with Canada, and it was basically a quid pro quo to Canada that included all kinds of things related to trade, border security. It really has no benefit to the United States. And advocates have believed all along that it was something that Canada wanted basically to deal with the numbers of asylum claimants or asylum seekers arriving at the border. There's nothing in it for the United States. And exactly what's happening now is exactly what we feared as we were fighting the agreement. Since it was initially proposed in 2001 and signed in 2002. And so what's happening now with human smuggling, people putting their lives at risk, trying to cross the border in an irregular fashion in the middle of winter, that's all points that we raised with both Canada and the U.S. From 2002 to 2004 when the agreement was implemented.
And maybe you should talk a little bit more because you have a perspective here, clearly. I mean, you are somebody who has worked with refugees in the United States, and you were very opposed to this Safe Third Country Agreement because of the reasons that you just said. But this was something that you were pretty active about.
Exactly. Many advocates, both in the U.S. and Canada, fought this agreement. And the primary reason that we fought the agreement is that we believe that asylum seekers or asylum claimants should have the right to access protection in the country of their choice. And tied in with that is many of us believed, especially post 9/11, that the United States was really never a safe country for asylum seekers. And I should a little bit about terminology, because in Vermont there's been a lot in the news about the Syrian refugees, and a 30-second primer on terminology. Refugees in U.S. terminology are individuals who, like the work that's the fantastic work that's done by Vermont Refugee Resettlement Program, those individuals, and like the Syrian refugees that were due to come, when they arrive in the U.S., their legal case has already been finished and decided.
Right. That happens abroad before they arrive,
exactly.
And then they get to the United States and they are
and
already –
And it's all about
they
resettlement,
have legal status, yeah.
English and schools. And the individuals that we worked with, the terminology is asylum seekers or asylum claimants. In Canada, they're called refugee claimants. Those individuals are still seeking protection. So our job was to meet with them, take on their legal case, and represent their legal cases either in the U.S. or helping them, assisting them to access the Canadian system. And there's many reasons why someone would decide to go to Canada. It could be cultural. It could be language ties. It could be family. So there's many reasons why asylum seekers move to a certain country. The notion of asylum shopping that you hear, to me, is kind of a cynical statement about what asylum seekers are looking for and the protections and security that they're trying to access. It's not like asylum seekers are out there looking for the President's Day sale on protection or asylum. They're trying to find the best place for themselves and their families, and they're looking for security. And one thing that I had wanted to mention at the beginning is just kind of an alert that if there is anyone listening to this show who is thinking about trying to access the Canadian refugee system, please talk with an attorney or good legal counsel before you go, because it's a human tragedy and a human safety situation on the border that we're dealing with.
We're going to talk more about this. We have to take a very quick break. We're talking about why immigrants, why refugees in the United States might be trying to get to Canada illegally with the aim of declaring asylum there. And we're looking at this history connected to the current situation. Listeners, if you have a question, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. I'm talking today with Patrick Giantonio, who ran the now not existing Vermont Refugee Assistance Program in the early 2000s. He's also the co-founder of NEST, New England Survivors of Torture and Trauma. We're talking about something called the Safe Third Country Agreement, signed by the U.S. and Canada, that tries to prevent people who want to declare asylum from being able to possibly declare in the U.S. and then maybe declare in Canada to basically decide between the two places they are required to declare asylum in the country they arrive in. The U.S. has more and busier ports of entry and is more likely to get asylum seekers arriving on its shores. So these people are required to declare in the U.S. and cannot then travel to Canada, where they might hope for a better reception. The unintended consequence of this agreement is that right now we are seeing people intentionally crossing the border illegally with the aim of getting caught, because if they do it that way, it's sort of a loophole. They can declare asylum in Canada. Patrick was around when this agreement was signed. He fought against it. He's telling us about that time and what he's seen and what his perspective is on the situation now. Listeners, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211 with your questions, or post them on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Let's go to Lise calling in from Bromont, Quebec. Hi, Lise. Go right ahead.
Hello, and thank you. I'm incensed about what I'm hearing right now. Anti-Muslim sentiment has gone up 400% in Ontario recently. They're coming here illegally. They're not freeing, they're not fleeing persecution or anything in the U.S. I want an end to this because it's costing us an arm and a leg. It's coming out of my income tax. They're giving them apartments and washers, dryers, free Medicare, free dental. I don't even get that. I'm paying for that. They haven't earned it. They haven't been here. They're pencil pushers. They don't come here to work. They come here to infiltrate government, and they take over, and that's what they want to do. I'm incensed at what's going on. I think they should be sent right back immediately.
Lisa, I can hear the emotion in your voice. Patrick, how would you respond? You have a lot of empathy and sympathy for people who are in these situations, but here's Lisa saying they're getting things I don't even have.
I guess what I would say to Lisa is that currently there's 21 million refugees worldwide, and that doesn't even account for the millions of individuals who are internally displaced people all over the world. I think it's our duty, and I think Canada, I have such deep respect for Canada through history to be welcoming, a welcoming community, country, government to refugees. The fact that Canada has taken in 40,000 Syrians as of the end of January, I think, is an amazing statement about Canadian outlook on the world. And
but again, that's legally. That's through the Canadian government. That's,
exactly.
That's through a declaration.
So what I would say to Lise is that the issues with people trying to cross irregularly at the border, what I would say is that's why we said do away with the Safe Third Country Agreement. Before the agreement was in effect in 2004, people would go to a port of entry. It was a very good process that people would follow. They'd report at a port of entry. They'd have their initial process there. There were far fewer irregular crossings as there are now because there was a system in place. And the Safe Third Country Agreement disrupted that entire system, which is why we fought it so aggressively between 2002 and 2004.
Did nobody see this potential loophole? I mean, why aren't people turned away even when they cross illegally if the aim is to keep this in place?
Jane, it was amazing. We made this argument to Congress. We were able – I was actually able to get the head of the Immigration Judges Association in California a letter from Dana Marks, who's the head of the immigration judges, saying that this was going to put a huge burden on the U.S. system. Everybody knew what was going to happen. We made these arguments that it was going to increase human smuggling.
And it has, do you think?
Oh, it has. It has, most definitely.
Is there proof of that?
I think there's anecdotal proof. But everything else that we're seeing, I heard about a case a couple days ago where a woman was trying to cross the border irregularly. She came upon the RCMP, the Mounties, and they notified her that she was probably going to have to be arrested. What I think we have to realize is these individuals have been traumatized. Many of them are torture survivors. When you say the word arrest to someone, she turned around, fled back into the arms of U.S. And was detained by Border Patrol. So, you know, there's human tragedies happening on the border right now that don't have to be happening if this agreement was suspended and abandoned.
Do you see any sign of that happening? As we heard earlier from Eric in Quebec, there's some talk about ending the Safe Third Country Agreement because of this assumption that both countries are safe may not be accurate, or at least that's what some people think. However, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has said, no, we're going to keep it in place for now. And there doesn't seem to be any conversation that I've heard at the highest levels in the U.S. of getting rid of this agreement either.
We're working on that.
So not the highest levels, but the lowest levels
but
perhaps?
We're moving up. And, you know, I think in Canada it's pretty widely accepted, well, by refugee advocates and I think by the general population that this is a really dumb deal. And Trudeau and his government, I think they're going to come along and see that this was from the very beginning a really stupid agreement. DHS Secretary John Kelly just released, and we had a leak memos a couple days ago, of new immigration policies that the U.S. is going to be enacting. And the U.S., it's very clear that since Donald Trump was elected president, the U.S. is less safe than it was. We're back to the way it was post 9/11 and much, much worse. They're going to be increasing detention for asylum seekers, and for an asylum seeker who is detained, and we use the word detained, what it really is jail, and people really need to understand that. And when an asylum seeker is in jail, it's incredibly difficult for them to access the resources to make a viable claim for asylum. And again, most of my clients, when I was representing asylum seekers, most of them were torture survivors. So you've got a torture survivor who is being re-traumatized daily by being detained in jail, in a jail-like setting. So
let's go to Robert calling in from Lac-Brome, Quebec. Hi, Robert. Go right ahead.
So, well, first of all, I'd like to point out that I'm calling from a municipality just next to the Bromont caller who was complaining about her taxes being abused and all that stuff. So not everybody up here is a Trump supporter, and many people are very sympathetic to the people crossing the border coming into the country. We have signed an international treaty, which under which we are obliged to consider refugees, and I think it ought to be made clear that somebody just looking for a better life is, even if he comes in and claims, or he or she claims refugee status, won't necessarily be granted that status after a hearing as it looks into whether their grounds for claiming refugee are true. If you're an economic refugee, you'll be asked politely to leave the country and to make an application for to come in as an immigrant. Refugees are in this country people who are fleeing persecution and who are in danger if they're returned to their country. So anyway, generally speaking, I and many of my friends are entirely sympathetic, and our government is equally very sympathetic. And of course, we have taken in as many people as we can. It's around 25,000 or 30,000 of Syrians.
Robert, thanks for your comments. I appreciate hearing from you and the pushback that you're offering to our earlier caller, Lise. Different opinions, different thoughts here. Even certainly in Canada, as with the U.S., there's a multitude of different perspectives on these issues. And Patrick, this has happened before. We've seen people coming through the United States on their way to Canada. This is an uptick, but just very briefly, put it in historical context for us.
Well, the interesting thing is Vermont Refugee Assistance was part of, and hearing a lot about sanctuary cities, sanctuary churches right now, and Vermont Refugee Assistance was part of a network of small community-based groups, nonprofits all over the country, in the 1980s that were providing sanctuary to mostly Central American refugees who were fleeing the wars, mostly U.S.-sponsored wars in Central America. So in the 80s, we were dealing with similar border crises. These individuals were going to Canada because they couldn't receive proper oversight over their case or the protections that they were looking for in the U.S. because of the relationship with the U.S. government and the Central American governments. So at that time, we were had people hosted all over the state of Vermont waiting to access the Canadian system. Then in the 2000s, we saw a surge, and it's something that I wanted to, when I was talking about an alert. It's important for people to know it doesn't take much to set off a surge at the border. In 2002, we saw a surge because of rumors that the Safe Third Country Agreement was going into effect when it actually wasn't until 2004. In 2003, we saw a surge, which was due to a U.S. policy that was introduced by George Bush and John Ashcroft, the then Attorney General, and Tom Ridge, who was the Homeland Security Director, that it was a Muslim registry, basically. And we saw whole communities of Pakistanis flee to Canada because they felt unsafe in the United States. Even green card holders, even people who had supposed safety here didn't feel safe. During that time, in February of 2003, there were 135 Canadian-bound asylum seekers who went to the border, were bounced back, and detained. My colleague, Michelle Janis, Michelle is an amazing human rights advocate. Michelle and I were running all over northern New York trying to track these individuals who were being detained in county jails all over New York. So we've seen this before. We've seen this before, and again, it really speaks to the lack of safety and security that people feel in the U.S. and that the U.S. is really not a safe country for many people to find protection that they're seeking.
Well, it's interesting context and interesting to have a better understanding of why what's happening now at the border is happening. Patrick D'Antonio is the former executive director of Vermont Refugee Assistance. He led that organization from 1995 to 2011. He also co-founded NEST, New England Survivors of Torture and Trauma. Thank you very much for talking with us, Patrick.
Thank you, Jane.
Before we leave this topic, we're going to get an update on the latest from VPR's Kathleen Masterson, who brought the issue of these illegal border crossings into the national spotlight last week and is in Canada today doing some more reporting. Kathleen, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Jane. Thank you.
So just a little bit more context that you've been finding during your time in Canada reporting. What are the countries where most of the asylum seekers entering Quebec are coming from?
Right. Well, in Quebec, the top three nationalities are people from Burundi, Eritrea, and Sudan. That's what they're finding in recent months.
U.S. Yeah, go ahead, Kathleen.
Yeah, and in Canada, it's similar. It's Eritrea, Burundi, and Syria. So those are the top claims in the whole country.
We've been talking about how when people cross the border illegally, they are then arrested by Canadian police who witnessed this. You reported on this. But it may be confusing to people why they aren't stopped by U.S. Border officials or police officers and prevented from entering Canada.
It's a really good question. I was wondering the same thing. And they do, you know, U.S. Border Patrol is well aware of these crossings. They often are stationed at Roxham Road, that popular crossing in upstate New York. And they actually have a system where when a cab gets a call, take me to Roxham Road or take me to a rural road bordering Canada, that the cabs will ping Border Patrol. And Border Patrol has the right to stop that car because they have a suspected non-citizen in the car. But if the person's paperwork's in order, so if they have a visiting tourist visa or if they are in application to be for refugee status. So if all their paperwork's in order, then the U.S. Border Patrol cannot stop them, even if it's quite obvious that they're walking across the border. It's only after they walk across the border that they've committed that illegal act. And then the Canadian side, which would be the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, those are the people that monitor in between the border checkpoints, then they could stop them and arrest them.
Because essentially it's not a U.S. crime to leave the U.S. It's only a crime to illegally cross the border into the country that you're crossing into, and then that country's authorities pick you up, basically.
Exactly. So it would be the same if somebody was walking from Canada into the U.S. Border Patrol could stop them right then and there on our side.
You visited people in Montreal who were arrested crossing the border, and many of them are staying at the YMCA. Can you tell us a little bit about the conversations you've had?
Sure. I mean, it was quite many different nationalities kind of flowing out of the building. And I must say a bunch of people did not speak either French or English. So I wasn't able to have an in-depth conversation with too many folks. But I did briefly talk to a couple that had come from the U.S. Into Canada. They didn't tell me how. They had very limited English. They were from Syria. So they were taking up refuge there and staying at that YMCA. And then there were women and children from various African countries. One of the guys spoke French and Arabic who was standing at the door, so he gave me a little bit of the color translating some of the Arabic into French, and my French is incredibly limited. But there were really a real range of people there, and it was unclear, I have to say, without people willing to share their full story, it was unclear to me how many people had come into Canada illegally or how many people were just at that residence while they're waiting out their asylum claim. But certainly quite a lot of folks from both African countries, Syria, and probably others that I wasn't able to tell the language they were speaking.
That's VPR's Kathleen Masterson. You can continue to follow all of her reporting on this topic. She will be doing more stories on this. You can follow it all at vpr.net. Kath, thanks very much.
Thanks, Jane. Take care.
Coming up, Colorado's Vail Resorts is buying Stowe Mountain Resort for $50 million. We'll have an update next on Vermont Edition. Big news from the ski industry this morning as Vail Resorts of Colorado has announced that it will purchase Stowe Mountain Resort in a $50 million deal. You're listening to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm, and we're going to talk about that now. Vail has properties in Colorado, Utah, California, and Nevada, but Stowe will be Vail's first East Coast resort. To talk about what this might mean, we're joined now by Alex Kaufman. He's host of VPR's Wintry Mixed podcast, and he has a long career working in the ski industry, including past work for some of Vail's competitors. Alex, nice to have you with us.
Thanks, Shane. Good to be here.
So this is a $50 million deal. That's great for Vail Resorts, great for Stowe Mountain Resort. But what's it going to mean for skiers who want to ski at Stowe?
Well, that's definitely the $64 million question. And the folks that like to ski in the East, now have something to argue about other than politics, and they're getting after it, everybody making predictions.
So what are some of the predictions? I mean, we were looking at reporting from VPR's Amy Noyes this morning, talking about lift tickets for a year pass at Stowe, or season pass, could top $2,000. Now, you know, many people are getting it cheaper than that, and people don't want to pay rack rate. But with Vail coming in and having a different ticketing system, could that mean a different season pass price?
It could, but it won't automatically. The ticket that you mentioned, I think, obviously Vail has their Epic Pass, which gets you access to all of their resorts all over North America and the world, actually. And the big question, or one of them, is, you know, what will happen to Stowe's season pass price, which was on either side of $2,000. Could it potentially go to $800, $900? Yes, it technically could, if it were just to be integrated flatly into their Epic Pass program. But the kind of side effects of that, as far as crowding, as far as whether the roads could handle it, the parking lots could handle it, the lodges could handle it, because it does increase visitation. At some of their resorts, when they've gone from pricing at the old model to Epic Pass, you've seen twice as many people there on a busy day, sometimes three times as many people on a busy day. And the question that remains to be seen is how Stowe, or rather how Vail, decides to go forward at Stowe in regards to their pricing. Because your pricing is kind of your one biggest lever for how you manage crowds. And if all of a sudden the season pass was more than half as much cost, that would definitely impact the operation. And how they move forward on that, I think, is anybody's guess. I would be highly, I think it's highly unlikely that they are able to do a $800 season pass at Stowe, would be my guess, just because of what it would do to the visitation.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting because in their press release, Vail Resort says they look forward to integrating Stowe Mountain Resort into the Epic Pass and other season pass products for the 2017-2018 winter season. And of course, the Epic Pass is the one that you can use at all Vail Resorts, and that ticket price is about $800. So it sounds like they're planning on integrating it. But Alex, you think that it may not be just a straight deal where suddenly skiers at Stowe can get the Epic Pass for $800?
Right. I do think it will definitely integrate, where no matter what pass you have at Stowe will be an Epic Pass. You'll be able to use it across their portfolio. The question becomes is, can they do it at the regular rate? Can they, at a drive-to resort that's hours from New York, hours from Boston, hours from Montreal, offer that price point as an Epic Pass? You know, potentially this will be their first time where they have to have, yes, it's an Epic Pass, but it still costs $1,800. I don't know anybody who says they know, doesn't know. One thing that is happening everywhere and will continue is folks will make predictions, but they won't really know. So it's very interesting, and it's not just the skiers that will be impacted. The competitors will definitely be watching very closely as well.
Yeah, what do you think about that? I mean, if suddenly you are able to get a much cheaper pass at Stowe, that certainly could impact some of the other ski resorts that are right nearby. Are they talking yet?
Oh, everybody's talking, that's for sure. That's the one thing that you can know for a fact. You know, Sugarbush, for example, you know, their full season pass right now is $1,800. So, you know, if all of a sudden Stowe went from around $2,000 to $800, that would definitely impact everybody. You might see some regional resorts working more closely together to offer more group pricing. You will definitely see some reaction in the marketplace if all of a sudden Stowe's price changes a lot. And if you see reaction in the Northern Vermont marketplace, that will inherently impact New Hampshire and Southern Vermont. So everybody, skiers and competitors, will be watching this one very, very closely.
Alex, another thing that we wanted to talk to you about was this situation that Vail Resorts often likes to trademark the names of their resorts. And of course, Stowe is not just a resort, it's also a town. Is that something you think might actually happen in Stowe, that Vail Resorts would try to trademark Stowe?
Well, I definitely don't know, and you'll hear that a lot. But in their most recent example, when they acquired Park City, they did take some steps to try and protect the term Park City, and the town became nervous because there's a lot of businesses in Park City that have Park City in their name, and they ended up at kind of a legal crossroads where the town was concerned what Vail might do with that trademark if they were to get it. Vail was saying, oh, no, we're only going to use it for resort-specific stuff. If you have a business in town that has Park City in its name, we're not going to come after you for that. But there ended up being, you know, some strife in that, and then I believe Vail Resorts abandoned that attempt. So I don't know if something similar would be coming down the pike at Stowe. I don't know the legal ramifications. But it did just occur at Park City a couple of years ago, and then Vail ended up not pursuing it. So perhaps similar result in Stowe, or perhaps they won't even attempt.
So the Stowe laundromat doesn't need to be worried quite yet.
Definitely not. There doesn't need to be a lot of worry at this point unless you are a competitor of Stowe, just because it may impact your product mix. You know, right now, it'll just be a lot of kind of fear of change. But in general, you know, Vail Resorts is a very, very strong operator. Folks should be happy and calm that, you know, the folks that are taking this over know exactly what they're doing to offer a good product. They're also very profitable. The questions come when, you know, are they good for seeing the corporatization of the sport? You know, those philosophical concerns.
Oh, only those small things, the philosophical concerns. Alex Kaufman, thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate your time today.
Thanks, Jane.
Alex Kaufman is host of VPR's Wintry Mix podcast, and he's been telling us a little bit more about this news that Vail Resorts of Colorado has entered into agreement to purchase Stowe Mountain Resort. Now, the story of Malala is well known. She's the Pakistani girl who was nearly assassinated for advocating for girls' education. She went on to win the Nobel Peace Prize for her efforts. But a new book by Vermont writer Tanya Lee Stone reminds us there are millions of Malalas in the world, and the barriers to their education are profound. Tomorrow on Vermont Edition, we'll talk with Stone about her new book, Girl Rising, and the impact that education has for girls in developing countries. Join us for that conversation tomorrow at noon. Our show is produced by Rick Singeri, Sam Gail Rosen, and Meg Malone. Mary Williams directed it, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.